Picture three men. They are beyond sight or healthy diet. Isolated by a virus, they decide to turn to old TV for solace. Will they find comfort? Or will they find the Twilight Zone? Welcome to the Twilight Zone Zone. This week, we have two new episodes in what I guess is our comedy episode of the Twilight Zone Zone. We are doing the last episode of season one, episode 36, called A World of His Own, not written by Rod Serling, but starring Rod Serling, written by Richard Matheson, who is best known for writing the horror novel I Am Legend, which was adapted six times, including The Omega Man, The Last Man on Earth, and, of course, the titular I Am Legend starring Will Smith. He also wrote the an upcoming episode of The Twilight Zone, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, where William Shatner sees something on the wing. So we're in capable hands here. The other episode we'll do is The Howling Man, which I'll talk to you about when we come back. Also written by Charles Beaumont, the guy who wrote the previous episode that we did in the last one, A Nice Place to Visit. As is traditional, I'm going to read the opening narration given by Rod Serling in his cigarette-infused monotone. By the way, the episode between the two that we did, After Hours and this one, which is A World of His Own, is one called The Mighty Casey, which if you guys haven't seen is completely absurd, where there's this incredible young baseball player called Casey, who's a pitcher and a hitter, and he's incredible, but he doesn't play when it rains because guess what? He's a robot. It's really a phenomenally stupid episode. Great.
Twist.
Oh, well, I thought...
What a twist!
He would have been a bad player because he never got rid of those sideburns, like Mattingly.
Oh, that's really funny. And I'm choking on my Moscow Mule. Or I guess it's a V&T. By the way, how crazy is this? This episode came out the 1st of July, 1960. The first episode of the season came out October 2nd, 1959. So that means it was literally a new episode for 36 straight weeks. That's absurd.
It's absurd today, but back in the day, it was like 36 weeks out of the year, you had to have a new episode because reruns didn't exist.
Right.
And syndication didn't really exist. I think I Love Lucy invented that. I don't know, yeah. But it was like 36 weeks, and then the rest would be like a summer special, which was all soap operas, game shows, and whatever, and then you would start up the season again.
Well, and you can get this here because between TV and radio, they would hire any writer they could get, I mean, which is kind of what's happening now between Disney Plus, CBS Interactive, and whatever they can scrape off their shoe to write a new Star Trek special. You scrape off the radio people. And that's why so many of these scripts are like narrating what she's doing as she's seeing it, which we talked about before. I do realize as well, I have not introduced my guests on this panel. The guy who's already been interrupting me is Daniel. Say hi, Daniel.
Hi, Daniel.
On panel is also Matt Quinn.
Yep, here I am.
And as I predicted somehow last week, returning to the show is John.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi, John.
And by the by, I appreciate John for a lot of reasons, mainly because I also have a brother, John, who properly spells John without an H. So, you
it's
know,
the best way to
when you're
spell
stealing
it.
His identity.
Are we going to single white female him?
That's right.
Oh, you can't steal his identity. I've already stolen his identity.
I am Mr. Kelly Copsey. Previous
guest,
you, Kelly,
she's got bigger balls
come back
than
around again, I assume, because when this inevitably returns in the fall, she made me promise we would do a Harry Potter series. Anyway, before we jump to our plot synopsis, let me give the opening narration. Of course, the home of Mr. Gregory West, one of America's most noted playwrights. The office of Mr. Gregory West, shy, quiet, and at the moment, very happy. Merry, warm, and affectionate. And the final ingredient, Mrs. Gregory West. So, as is tradition next, We need a plot synopsis. John, you got it for us?
Sure, yeah. This one's pretty simple, actually. As the narration said, we start out with Mr. Gregory West. There he is, right there. With Mary, this gorgeous-looking blonde woman who is just dripping all over him. And they seem very happy. And then along outside the window, we see Mrs. Gregory West. And she is suitably shocked. Yeah. She walks into the room fully expecting a fight. And she sees just her husband, Gregory, standing there by himself with no girl to be seen. And she pokes about the room. She's very suspicious. She's trying to be coy. And I think he's understanding that she's trying to be coy because it's a strange kind of interplay with them. She's knocking on walls, saying, "Oh, I'm just checking out the walls." "Okay, dear, yes, you do that." He proceeds to tell her that the girl that she saw wasn't real, that he can create people by dictating it into a dictation machine, and then he can make them go away by burning the tape. And, of course, Mrs. West has she doesn't believe him at all. No. And so the whole episode is their interplay as he tries to convince her that he has this power.
And as it's pointed out, we should mention that the man, Gregory West, as he's mentioned, is played by Keegan Wynn, and he is it's funny because they're almost making fun of sitcoms in general, because he's just a dumpy white balding dude. And he has two women fawning over him. Again, it's the Flintstones. It's the Simpsons. It's Family Guy. It's anything it's starring... Yeah, exactly.
Well, there was that episode where Homer joined a gime and got pretty buff.
Yeah, yeah, man. Tell episode. Me more about how sexy Fred Flintstone is.
Oh, he's super sexy when he's lighting up.
Well, you might
famous for
brand cigarettes.
Keenan Wynn is known for a couple things. He was the voice of the Snow Miser in the claymation Santa Claus is Coming to Town. The Winter Warlock or whatever that was. If you're an MST3K fan, he was in Laser Blast. And probably the most famous thing he did was Major Bat Guano in Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah, that's the one. And the other one, for those of you who are not Daniel... he's also in a fantastic musical called Annie, Get Your Gun. He's in the 1950s. He's Charlie Davenport.
Is that a sequel to Annie?
Yes. That's when she goes back to the orphanage with a gun and fixes things.
That would be a hell of a sequel.
That's right. Miss Flanagan, or whatever her name is about to get it.
That's right. Yeah. Phyllis Kirk is the real wife. She's in a bunch of TV that you probably haven't seen. In fact, this episode of The Twilight Zone is like her third most important thing. However, the blonde, Mary LaRoche, is her character, is her real name. She's in Bye Bye Birdie and Gidget, so you might have seen her more often.
If you're 70, you might have seen her more often.
I don't know, man. I think old school musical theater is bigger than you think. I will say.
You might be right.
But yeah, so again, we'll figure out how to do this eventually. We should talk through this. I mean, it's that standard Twilight Zone where the first twist is done in about 3 minutes. You see a woman looking through a window, a blonde in a kind of loose-fitting blouse, which I only mention because the wife brings it up later, brings a man a cocktail. And again, she's, you know, young, attractive, and vivacious, though, as is pointed out, they're not overly attractive. They're just out of his league. Brings him a drink, and it's a very kind of not necessarily sexy scene, but it's an intimate scene. They're looking at each other lovingly, and then you notice this weird woman wearing all black with dark hair peering in the window. In fact, whatever wonderful human being wrote this describes it as, Mary is displeased, and you're just like, what are you even watching? She's furious.
The whole thing about this was Gregory was dreaming up the ultimate fantasies that he wanted in his life, and it would actually happen, which would have been an interesting episode, but he never gets punished for those fantasies.
This to me, of the ones we've done, with maybe a few exceptions, feels the most like something that could be turned almost directly into an X-Files episode. But it wouldn't be the dude. Or maybe it would be the dude. It could be the dude. But otherwise, it's like the magic microphone he speaks into.
If I can cut in here real quick, wouldn't that have been a great episode for both the Twilight Zone and the X-Files if people realized they had that power and it was Scully who was describing her ultimate fantasy?
It would be. If, like, there was, like, some sort of... She was talking about... I mean, when you talk about ultimate fantasy, you immediately have edged into fan fiction. But, like, if she's talking to a fortune teller about... That is a suspect in a crime, and she's describing her perfect man, and then it walks through the door, and it's just David Duchovny with a mustache, and you're just like, ha-ha, David Duchovny with a mustache.
Well, I mean, he's literally created by a middle-aged man.
Oh, God help me, you're right. Yeah. That's very funny.
There have been other TV episodes of other famous TV shows that have been all about Gary Stews. Buffy, that one episode where Jonathan becomes the main character.
Well, actually, you know what? We can get to that at the end of this. As I mentioned, kind of, I alluded to at the beginning, this is almost the closed door farce episode of the show, right? This is them running around trying to figure out what's going on, and literally they lock the door. As the wife enters the room, the mystery woman is just gone. Right. There's this weird scene where the wife is like kind of floating around, looking behind curtains, trying to find a secret door, as though this woman is, you know, she's being cheated on and the woman is in hiding.
Yeah. And she eventually manages to wheedle out of her husband this woman's name.
Mary.
Well, right. Mary, I had no idea I had so many friends.
And from there... Please, John.
Well, it's definitely one of the tropes that I'm a little surprised Matt didn't bring up, that it's the embittered wife who accuses the husband of cheating, and she's checking all the doors and windows for the mistress. And she's literally looking for a secret door where this Mary could be hidden. And she can't find
well,
it.
She
and
kind
so
of reminded
this
me,
episode is just playing off that.
She right. kind of reminded me of Joan Crawford, that same sort of presence in a TV show or a movie. They look similar, and it was just that same strong, assertive dominance in any scene that she's in.
And I mean, or yeah. I was thinking of, by the end, it's almost Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Like, it's almost manic, right? And she's convinced that not only the husband is lying, but then as he explains stuff, it's also that he's crazy.
Which isn't helped
but it's
when
so
he
funny
locks her
that
in the room.
No, it doesn't.
She does a good job. The actress does a very good job of portraying that panic where he locks her in the room and she's afraid that he is psychotic. He's making up this story about his mistress being just created from his own voice recorder. She's right. repeatedly saying, I'm going to have you committed. You're crazy. Let me out of here. And kind of harking back to our last episode, the after hours, kind of the feminist critique, like she's being held against her will. Her husband is right. probably crazy and she has no way out. Literally.
Yeah. No one's touched on this, but, the fact that Mary is a creation of his own imagination brought to physical life, he's still cheating on his wife with her, regardless.
Well, we will get to that.
Well, there's also a scene where he can create anything he wants to, like an elephant in his home's hallway, specifically so he can keep his wife trapped.
Yeah, well, and that's where the episode takes the turn, right? Because it proves that if it's his brain... or the microphone in his tape recorder, something about it makes the elephant, I think it's described as an elephant red-eyed with rage, blocks the doorway, or whatever it is. It's that fury, it's that rage. And when the elephant appears, not only is she terrified of the elephant, but she looks at him with a new kind of horror, then composes herself. And then prepares to manipulate him. which is fascinating. This is actually a very interesting scene to do as an acting scene, you know?
Acting.
Sure, I get it.
Right.
And actually, kind of along those lines, so far, when I was watching this, I felt like this was really a one-act play. Like, I could have seen this just right. as, like, seeing it in the West End or Broadway or something like that. Just, it's two, three people just standing on a stage in one room, kind of acting together. And I thought that worked out very well in this show.
And actually, along those lines, this might be the one that feels the most, you know, like a bottle, like, episode or a chamber drama. And it's funny. I mean, it's Judd Apatow's line about this, which is that a comedy is a drama with jokes, right? Because it is a very dramatic scene. You think your husband's cheating on you with this woman who you can't find, and then he says that she's imaginary. That's an interesting idea, and it's very dramatic. And without the humor of the two actors who are playing it very admirably, it is a very dark, weird, horrifying, you know, nightmare of a scene. That are you hallucinating? Is he lying? Which is the truth?
You know what would have been interesting? If it was the wife who could create anyone that they wanted to, and she created that docile husband figure, and when he started cheating, she was like, you know what? I created you from my thoughts, and you've disappointed me.
That no, would be interesting. I will yeah. fix your idea. I was going to say, I was going to fix your idea even more, because you're right, but it would be her paranoia that her creation was cheating on her. It makes it more Frankenstein-y, that the creation is the one that becomes more important than the creator, right?
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, and then you paint the whole thing like the man in the gray flannel suit, the dowager or the old maid type who, tragically, at the age of 24, isn't married. So she creates her ideal husband, and the ideal husband is the one who goes out with the barmaid. But is it what she wants to make her life more dramatic, because she's created a life that makes her mundane?
That was the thing in this episode, was that the imaginary characters no longer responded to Gregory West's will.
And at this point, I guess we should give away the twist, right? I guess, John, you introduced this. Do you want to give us the twist?
Yeah. So They have their argument, and the husband says, well, I'm sorry, you're no longer doing what I asked you to, and you have to go. And he reveals through a safe that there's an envelope with her name on it, and inside is a roll of film or recording, and he tosses it into the fireplace, and she's scoffing at him the whole time, and then she disappears. And she was right. made up by him from the beginning.
And he then decides whether or not he's going to resurrect her or Mary one last time. And Mary, by the way, who has become sick of being his kind of emotional, sexual, whatever fantasy, says, don't revive me if you don't mean to keep me around. And he resurrects her instead of the wife, which is just, again, it's
an interesting idea.
High satires, whatever it is. Yeah,
I'm it's so an interesting idea. He brings her back, and she seems to remember that she's doing that.
Exactly. I'm so glad you guys brought that up. I mean, does that mean they can recall every time they were created and uncreated? Because that would be a much more interesting Twilight Zone if somebody was only in existence for a brief amount of time and they decided they didn't like it. I mean, if I was rewriting this, that's where I'd started. Matt, I know you do the how I would have done this. What are your thoughts?
I don't really have any. I mean, I like the twist that the wife was a creation too.
Yeah.
And I thought this episode was actually really funny. Like when he summons Mary, the mistress, back, and the two of them just look at each other, and I just could not stop laughing.
Sure.
Like, instead of a horror story, this was a comedy.
I 100% right. agree. And to me, that's what makes it the perfect way to end the season. Because, again, I mean, you guys, at this point, I assume, have listened to all of them. I watched this season through a few times at this point. Most of them are dark. Some of them are cynical. A few are satiric. But this one is the closest to a flat-out comedy in that first season. And we'll get to the epilogue, which is the best thing of all.
Oh, boy.
But, like, this one almost is a parody of the whole rest of this season. Like, you think you're screwed up. What if all of this was nonsense because it's a show? Oh, wait. And I get to relieve the ending then. Rod Serling appears to give his epilogue, which, I guess, since it's tradition, at a certain point, I should give two, unless someone has something else they want to say.
I was going to comment that the wife still thinks he's insane, even though he has somehow managed to magically create and uncreate an elephant.
And I guess to Matt's point, she's the one who throws her own envelope onto the fire, and she does kind of like, I feel funny. Oh no, oh no! And then she's gone. Right.
Mr. Stark, well, I don't feel so good.
I was about to say that. You got it.
Too soon.
Too soon. Fuck you. This is all over. Anyway, so Rod appears and he's sitting on a desk, cross-legged and handsome at the age of 24, but looking like he's 43. And he says, "We hope you enjoyed tonight's romantic story on the Twilight Zone. At the same time, we want you to realize that it was, of course, purely fictional. In real life, such ridiculous nonsense could never." And then Gregory responds. And he goes, "Rod, you shouldn't, Rod Serling." And he pulls out this envelope marked Rod Serling. "I mean, you shouldn't say such things as nonsense and ridiculous." And then he throws the tape onto the fire. And Serling's last line of the entire season is literally, "Well, that's the way it goes." And then he fades out of existence. Gregory has a drink with Mary. And then Serling comes back and goes, "Leaving Gregory West, still shy, quiet and happy, and apparently in complete control of the Twilight Zone." My goodness, what a great way to end this show.
Well, that could very well have been a series finale. Yeah. Who knows if it was getting renewed when they wrote that.
Yeah, no, you're right. And we know it came back in 88 and in 2000 and now being run by Peele, which I haven't watched yet. And I will, because I love this shit, obviously. But what a spectacular way to end the episode. I'm not saying that this episode wins over the next one we're going to do regardless, but that's a hell of a strong... Again, Phil Minor, ontological slippage, you got me immediately. But let's switch over to the next episode.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
So this episode is a few into season two. In fact, it's episode 5 of season 2. Also not written by Serling. This is the first time we've done a non-Serling episode entirely, but it is written by Charles Beaumont, the same guy who wrote an earlier episode, like I said, in the introduction.
Well, if I can make another reference,
Beaumont, you devil!
Well done. I believe you even texted me the same thing earlier.
All day, every day.
Oh, buddy. If someone would even read our texts, we'd almost be funny. So at this point, we're 5 episodes into the second season. They're already at episode 42 or 41 overall, which is just tells you how they used to pump this shit out. Wow, I almost read that wrong. The prostrate form, not the prostate form, the prostrate form of Mr. David Ellington, scholar, seeker of truth, and, regrettably, finder of truth. A man who shortly will arise from his exhaustion to confront a problem that has tormented mankind since the beginning of time. A man who knocked on the door seeking sanctuary and found, instead, the outer edges of the Twilight Zone. We have a story told in flashback by an American. Matt, you want to give the plot synopsis?
He's traveling in Europe after the end of World War One, and he gets lost in a rainstorm and comes upon a monastery. And the monks eventually agree to allow him to stay the night, but he hears howling and finds they've got a man locked up. And the man insists the people in the monastery are all insane. They're keeping him prisoner. And the monks are basically pull that Obi-Wan different point of view. You know, we have no man imprisoned here because he's not a man. Or is he?
In previous episodes, we've talked about whether or not something feels like a Twilight Zone episode or an X-Files episode or whatever. This, to me, feels the most like an X-Files episode that we've done because it's kind of, like Matt kind of slyly alluded to, is this man a person? Is he not? What is he? And very clearly, if you had the dichotomy of a Mulder and Scully, Mulder would think he is the devil or a monster or a demon. And Scully would be like, no, he's just a man. And she would be partially intrigued by him, but also sternly playing someone 10 years older than she is.
Now, if I recall correctly, Mulder was an atheist and Scully was more religious.
Very Catholic.
That could have been a more interesting dynamic in those characters.
I'm rewatching The X-Files with a podcast called The X-Files Files, which don't read too much into that. That's something they're exploring. Like, it's an interesting dichotomy that he believes in something, and it's that the government is lying to them and that, you know, this conspiracy is true, which doesn't sound like any group of people in America that I know. And on the other hand, she's very religious and believes that those people are nonsense, but is also very cynical of facts as they build, which also doesn't sound like any group of Americans I know. So it doesn't seem to apply to real life, but you'd think it would.
Well, it's like that old Eddie Izzard bit about Martians with big elbows.
This is a very elbowy episode then. Frankly, in this one, the acting, of course, is good across the board. I don't believe anyone stands out except for one very key person. Well, I guess we'll get to him. So there's H.M. Winant, who is the main character, who appeared in every show that you can think of until he died at 97. Or no, he's still alive, sorry, at 93, rather. I misread that. But he was in Hawaii Five-0. He was in Perry Mason. He was in the old Wild West show and Gunsmoke and Hogan's Heroes and Mission Impossible in Dallas. Like, he acted through that period like crazy. But the one, of course, that we're all thinking of is the patriarch of the Carradine family was in this. He's the one who plays the old brother at the head of the monastery that they watch ashore on, John Carradine.
Brother Jerome is who you're thinking of.
Looking like Moses in Desperate Need of Just for Men.
John Carradine was basically the Greatest Generation version of Charlton Heston.
That's a good way to put him. He appears in like literally everything from that time period. So yeah, this is as a structural story. It's kind of like a fish out of water thing. We have a man who appears in this kind of a world that's not. We get the feeling that it's supposed to be a, you know, vague yet menacing European place. You know, if it was an episode of, say, Futurama or whatever, it would be like the planet, like Romania. Like, it'd be like Transylvania-esque. Because it's a generic castle filled with monks holding, like, Moses canes and all with these phenomenal beards. And he's looking for respite, and everyone says no. And as an American, he demands that people speak English and say, hey, where am I supposed to sleep? I demand entrance into your place. Hey, where's the booze and the women?
Well, you know, now that you describe it that way, I realize what this is, which is F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu, which is about this foreigner who goes... Yeah, it's about a foreigner who goes into this old town where they're all telling him, no, don't go up that way because there's only monsters there. And he faints in the castle, and then while in that castle, he is greeted by this random old guy, and that random old guy isn't what he thinks they are.
To wit, where this episode works is the fact that it's an American, and he's dealing with these two different worlds, right? as an American, he wants justice. He wants to fight for things. And Rod Serling, as we mentioned in the previous episodes, is a dude who gets almost kicked out of Hollywood because he believes in equality and anti-war, and he's against this racist pull in the South, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so it makes sense that he's someone who would fight for this justice. But
how
this is
religious was Rod
Europe.
Serling? I never thought he was a really religious guy. At least he wasn't publicly.
I think he was Jewish.
I don't think he
became a Unitarian to get married.
Yeah, I don't think he is, but I think he believes in justice. It's again, I don't mean to get my own old school historiographical here, but I always felt it was more like a social justice. It's like a neo-Marxian kind of like everyone is equal more than it is purely religious. But again, it's worth mentioning here, he didn't write this episode. Regardless, at this point, we have this character, Ellington, torn. He wasn't invited, and now he's entering someone else's world. We have the literal battle of good and evil. You just have to depend on your interpretation, figure out who's good and who's evil. So we have the elderly, like, monks who are saying, the person we have is not a person, he's a devil. And on the other hand, we have a charming man with a beard. We can't trust any of them because it's the 1950s/early 60s, and everyone has a beard, so they're clearly communists and communist fools. But they're trying to establish who's good and who's evil.
And it is portrayed in a very interesting way that when we're introduced to them, the monks seem to be wicked. They're very standoffish. They don't want to let the American stay, even though he's obviously ill. And meanwhile, they have a seemingly very piteous person in a jail cell, and they're not letting him out. And they refuse to believe that he's there, or they don't admit that he's there.
I think that was the most important thing about this religious order, is that they don't necessarily act like monks would, which would be welcoming and inviting. They're more like superstitious and far more closed off from what's
but
actually
to get
happening
your point about
around the world.
About whether Rod Serling was religious, they don't. They act like Catholic Orthodox monks, but they say they don't hold to any dogma, only to the truth.
And again, part of it to me maybe is that it was a half hour show. I want to explore this one, and I'm not saying which one wins this week. This one is the one that I wish was almost a TV hour back then, like 50 minutes, because this is such an interesting, complicated zone, because it's an interesting idea. Do you have the devil, right? What if you find someone who's corrupt and charming and charismatic? And, you know, again, I don't know. It reminds me of like, Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Where they have the Robert Johnson proxy, and he's talking about going to the crossroads to meet the devil, and they're all describing the devil that they think it is. Is it a red guy with a bifurcated tail, or is it a charming white guy who just can swallow you up with his lies?
I think they kind of address that well with how the devil can appear in many forms. The one thing I didn't particularly care for was John Carradine lifting up the staff going, I trapped the devil with the staff of truth. It's like, what is
his
that?
His magic stick?
Yeah, a stick. Exactly.
John Carradine's
that's
magic
right.
stick is a very powerful
stick indeed.
Although,
I mean, I guess
indeed.
To wit, that's what makes, as an American, us feel weird and cynical, right? And this is not me trying to sound like I'm super Catholic or believe in super Catholic things, but I've been to Bruges and seen the blood that turns liquid every year, and I've been to Paris and seen the crown of thorns. And you know, if you're the right-minded person for that, there's that miracle involved. And so what if there's that person? And again, as a nation of Protestants, there's that itch in the back of your head that you're just like, well, that's old school European hoodoo. And I think that's what it's playing off of. Whoever wrote this, and of someone who I'm not going to look up, other than it's not our golden god, Rod Serling, there's something very interesting in the fact that it's playing off old school religious beliefs, which is why I felt like it was old X-Files nonsense, which again is my warm.
It's almost like Dracula, isn't it? That it, you've got the foreigner coming into an Eastern European country and stumbling upon evil and not knowing really how to react to it, trying to force his modern sensibilities onto what is obviously evil, and you know, it doesn't turn out very well.
And in particular, it's that absentee religious person stumbling on a super religious person who's name dropping shit, and you're just like, oh, okay. I mean, because again, you mentioned Dracula or whatever, but you know, at the end, the hero of Dracula or whatever is someone like Van Helsing, who's a super knowledgeable person explaining it to idiots. Here, our main character is the idiot. He's not a bad guy. He's a good guy with general good feelings towards people. But he's trying to figure out a bunch of whole, like, old people nonsense between two sets of nonsenses. I mean, with a beard like that, how can you not? He's either going to tell you religion or how Marxism works.
It's very authoritarian.
It is.
But I thought the devil did a very good job of portraying himself piteously. And honestly, that guy who played him was very good. When I first saw him, I thought he was Peter O'Toole, just because the accent and the makeup that they had him in was very Lawrence of Arabia. He did a really good job of portraying himself as, oh, woe is me, like, these guys are horrible, you should let me out now.
Matt brought up earlier that he was Unitarian. But frankly, I don't think that matters here, because to me, it seems like, and we'll get to the end of this, but the idea of the Twilight Zone is invoked because the twist is supposed to be hyperbolic. This to me feels like, what if the battle of good and evil happened at a Denny's? Like, if we're talking archetypes, Satan just literally translates to someone who is supposed to tempt you. Jesus is supposed to be divine. Here we have a situation where we have a neutral body torn between goodness and badness. But what if badness is just charming? Like, I don't think we need a particular religious background. The same script could be played out in any major religion, right? It's karmic. It's you know, Jesus, it's Jewish, it's Muslim, it's almost primal. It's a very interesting idea.
Well, the idea is the devil is the deceiver. You know, he's not the goat god on the throne of skulls.
I think this might be the most philosophical we've gotten with the Twilight Zone. If only it had ended with an atomic blast. That would have been easy and very 1960s.
So are we going to get to how it ends?
Matt, you want to hit us up with that ending?
Well, he basically, the brother Jerome tells our friend Ellington that the man is not a man. He's literally the devil. They've captured him and locked him away. And since then, the only evil that's happened is the minor evils people in the village do to each other. No world wars, no evil political ideologies, etc. And Ellington eventually is persuaded to let him out, because what's holding the door to his cell closed is the Staff of Truth, and he actually is the devil. He walks by some pillars, and every time he passes by a pillar, the horns on his forehead get more and more Hellboyish, and eventually he just escapes the monastery, and Brother Jerome is like, you're never going to forget what you did.
Well, and that's the rub of the whole idea, right? If we make statements that could lead to, and again, it's the idea that after World War One, they capture the devil, and by releasing the devil, World War Two and the atomic bomb and the Cold War and all these things are released. Like, they literally say these things, which is, if you can control the devil, you need to. You can't pretend his charm is better or whatever. It's an interesting thing about temptation and how feeling like you're being righteous can prevent mass death. And so our antagonist, which becomes our protagonist, Ellington, signals that the rest of his life is going to be about trying to track down the devil. He thinks he has the devil locked up in his room, and that's left to his maid, where we hear the howling once more as he's trying to get Brother Jerome.
Per you were saying earlier about good intentions, or like he's a good guy, he thinks eventually comes around to thinking the monks are a bunch of perverts who've got this guy captive, and for good intentions he lets him out, only it turns out he's literally the devil, and then he eventually recaptures him. But now the maid is getting tempted again, and for all we know she's a nice person too.
I, you know what, I think that's totally fair. I think we're about ready to wrap it up, guys. Matt, are you ready to give me your synopsis?
You mean which one I thought was better?
Yeah, please.
Okay, I thought the A World of His Own was better because I thought The World of His Own was hilarious.
Sure.
The other one is just meh. The Howling Man.
John?
Yeah, I thought this was a good episode. And actually, when I first started watching it, I thought this was an episode where the director had just learned what a Dutch angle was, and he insisted on using it constantly. And he did, to his credit, he did use it pretty effectively to portray the I guess insanity or uncertainty of the main character. It did well with giving that hint of insanity that Twilight Zone is known for, and uncertainty of whether the devil is the devil and whether the brothers are real or whether they're the good guys or the bad guys or whatever. And honestly, I was incredibly impressed with the special effects where the man turns into the devil. Like it's one long scene where looking back, like you can see where they cut it as every time he walks past a column, he grows more grotesque. So he turns from a man into what we consider the devil with horns, but he becomes more evil as he goes. And it's incredibly well done. And just technically, this is a fantastic episode. Plot-wise, it's a bit light. I think they could have done more, but with a half an hour, they did what they could. And no, I think it was very enjoyable, very, very suspenseful, and pretty good as far as an episode goes.
Do you have a preference between the two?
I think I prefer the first one, World of His Own, just because I thought they did a little bit better in plot-wise on that one.
Totally. Daniel, what do you got?
Of the two, I think The Howling Man is a better episode, simply because I think the stakes are a lot bigger, which I love big stakes in Twilight Zone episodes. I mean, the original one with Keenan Wynn would have been a whole lot more interesting if his existence meant more. I mean, basically, he's just God who is fulfilling whatever desire he can think of. But it's all strictly limited to his world and what he wants. We never see his impact on the outside world. And I don't think that's the case in The Howling Man, which makes that a whole lot more interesting, which is somebody's not only punished for their hubris, but they have an impact on the world because they release the devil. It's interesting because I don't know what Rod Serling's religious views were, but that at least gives me a glimpse into them and his views of humanity.
I am the most torn between two episodes we've ever done. In some way, these are both the most absurd and the most real that we've done. The ontological slippage of the first one appeals to me more as a comedy than I've seen in a long time. It's as aware as a Muppet movie. It's truly remarkable. The second one is the most gray area one. We don't see too much punishment based on someone's choices as opposed to who they are, which hasn't happened before either. I will say I'm tempted to choose the same as Daniel, not because I inherently agree with him. I mean, fuck that guy. But mainly because I think both of these are worth watching. Although I will say, to John and Matt's point, and I guess my point earlier, I think Matt said this is almost the perfect way to end all of your Twilight Zone watching. that first one. So instead of watching it when it comes up at the end of the season, you should almost watch it when you've watched every other episode of The Twilight Zone and you want one more thing to watch, and then it proves that it's all some sort of nonsense. That's awesome. Although I will say, as someone who is Catholic, I also appreciate Catholic horror in that way. But we need to talk about what's coming up next.
Oh, you also need to give the final narration.
I do, in fact, as John pointed out, I need to give my final wrap-up in terms of the closing. Quote, an ancient folk say, you can catch the devil, but you can't hold him long. Ask Brother Jerome, ask David Ellington. They know, and they'll go on knowing to the end of their days and beyond. In the Twilight Zone. So the next two episodes for next week, whenever next week is, you know, given weeks, it's Eye of the Beholder, which is episode number 6 of this season, and 22, which is appropriately episode 17 of this season. So stay tuned next week as whatever comes out, and we re-enter the Twilight Zone. Thanks, guys. The Twilight Zone Zone is a production of Dude Letter Podcasting and Myopia Defend Your Childhood. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, paneled by Daniel S. and Matt Quinn. It is edited by Nick and Daniel. The theme song is 6 Impromptus, Opus 5, Impromptu 5 by Jean Sibelius. The list is from Vanity Fair, the 26 episodes we talk about when we talk about The Twilight Zone by Donald Liebenson. The Twilight Zone is created, hosted, and mostly written by Rod Sterling. The Twilight Zone and all clips are owned by CBS Television and Cayuga Productions.